Moto Casino, American Social Casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, American Social Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
Chilling tales for dark nights.
The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs, and become a patron today to show your support and get instant access to our extensive archive of downloadable tales of terror. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the show. Disclaimer. Horror Hill is a horror anthology podcast bringing you scary stories from all corners of the internet and beyond. As such, certain stories include content that some listeners might find offensive. Listener discretion is advised. Hello there, friends, and welcome back to Horror Hill. I'm Eric Peabody, your host and narrator. And tonight's episode celebrates that most hallowed of youthful events, spring break. But rest assured, listeners, this episode does not feature copious drinking, electronic dance music, or any bronze-skinned attractive revelers. I can personally attest to that last one. No, tonight we'll be featuring two stories that take us into places filled with glorious natural beauty, and maybe a bit more. We'll start with Ecosystem by Micah Edwards, which follows a group of friends on a camping trip that are about to make quite the zoological discovery. After that, we'll crack into The Derelict by Christian Wallace, where a team of salvagers on the open ocean realize that the cruise ship they're processing might not be as abandoned as they thought. Grab your sunscreen and ball caps, folks. We're actually heading out into the sun for a bit. You're listening to the free edition of this program. If you'd like to help support Horror Hill and also remove these pesky ads, head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. You'll get instant access to hundreds of ad-free stories, so what are you waiting for? Also, if you're watching on YouTube, do us a favor and drop a like and subscribe. Become part of our dark circle, listeners. And now, from author Micah Edwards, I give you Ecosystem. It was supposed to be a fun weekend in the woods. The four of us had rented a little house with a backyard that opened onto 6,000 acres of forest or something like that. Honestly, I hadn't paid that much attention to the details. Amelia had said, "Do you want to go on a trip?" And I had said yes. It could have been swimming with sharks, rock climbing, or skydiving, and I would have said yes. She was always the planner. I was just the guy who went along with the plans. It was us and another couple, Mateo and Allie. Allie and Amelia had known each other since middle school. They were both big into glamping, which as far as I could tell meant wilderness trips that also had hot tubs available at the end of the day. I'd always done the tent camping, sleep on the ground, cook meals unevenly over a fire kind of thing, but since the first time Amelia had taken me glamping, I had to admit it was a lot more comfortable, and the food was better. I kind of wish we had been tent camping on this trip, though. It wouldn't have made anything better, but it would have made it faster. Sometimes that's the best you can hope for. It started out perfectly well. The cabin was this great little place, rustic enough to be homey, but modern enough to actually keep the air conditioning in and the bugs out. The main room had comfortable couches and huge windows looking out over the forest, which was as wild and inviting as promised. A large wooden deck wrapped around the side and back of the house, with stairs that led down to a path winding off into the forest. "Says here that's a private spur to the White Loop Trail," said Mateo, reading from a small booklet he had picked up from the table. 6 miles, easy circle. Want to get a quick hike in before dinner?" Allie put a finger to her chin in a mock thinking gesture. "We could, or we could just get into the hot tub." "We can do that after we get back," protested Mateo. "We can sit in the hot tub after the sun sets. We can't go hiking in the dark." "We can't fix the hot tub in the dark either," said Allie. "What makes you think it's broken?" "What makes you think it works?" she countered. "Plus, even if it's perfect, it's never easy figuring one of these things out the first time. They're all different, they're all finicky, and they're all much more annoying to figure out in the dark." "We came here for the hiking, though, right?" Mateo looked to me and Amelia for help, but to no avail. Amelia was clearly siding with her longtime friend, and honestly, I thought Allie had made a solid point, too. Besides, we'd been in the car for hours to get there. I was feeling like a soak in the hot water would do me a lot more good than a sweaty walk over uneven ground. Mateo saw the expressions on our faces and raised his hands in defeat. "Or we could make sure the hot tub works. You know, I was just thinking that we should probably check on that first thing on our hiking weekend. Clearly the best way to kick it off." Allie gave him a kiss. "I accept your reluctant surrender. Petulance is a surprisingly good look on you. I don't know how you do it." "Rugged good looks and lumberjack charm," he told her, as they disappeared out the back door to investigate the hot tub. "Shall we go put on our suits?" Amelia asked me. "Suits," I said. "I was planning to just skinny dip. Who can see us way out here?" "Allie and Mateo for two. Go put your trunks on." "What if I didn't bring any?" "Then Mateo can have a hiking buddy after all, and Allie and I will enjoy the hot tub all by ourselves."
"Enjoy it like how? I could set up a camera."
"I will throw your phone in the water," Amelia warned me.
"Destroying cell phones at the remote cabin in the woods. I've seen movies with that plot. They never end well," I said. It seemed very funny at the time.
The hot tub, much to Mateo's annoyance, started with the push of a single button and rapidly heated to the perfect temperature. I ignored his grumbling and sank gratefully into the water. I was looking forward to the hiking as much as he was, but Allie was right. This was the way to kick off the weekend. We stayed in the hot tub until well after the sun had set, drinking beers and arguing over what the sounds from the forest were. The hooting of the owls was clear enough, even for city people like us, but everything else was open to debate. Amelia insisted that the long, drawn-out cree noise was from frogs, while I insisted it was crickets. There was a shuffling, grunting noise at one point that Mateo perked up at.
"Those are wild pigs," he said.
"You sure it's not a bear?"
Allie asked uncertainly. He shook his head.
"Definitely pigs. They're hunting. That means there are good mushrooms nearby."
"Or at least there were until feral pigs ate them," I said.
"You'll see," said Mateo. "You ever have chicken of the woods? I bet we could find some tomorrow. It's delicious."
"If it's still there tomorrow, doesn't that mean that the pig rejected it?" Allie asked. "If a pig won't eat it, I'm not going to either, especially because they probably tasted it first. I'm definitely not eating something a pig licked." I will accept your apologies tomorrow when I cook the chicken of the woods I find, and you all agree it's the best thing that you've ever tasted," said Mateo. "That a pig licked," said Amelia. We all laughed, even Mateo. All of a sudden, there was a shriek from the woods. It was pitched higher than any human voice I'd ever heard, but it carried an unmistakable note of terror. We all looked at each other uncomfortably. "Fox, maybe?" said Amelia. "They scream really weirdly sometimes." There was a short silence. We were all listening, but all there was to hear was the background noise of the forest. Nothing followed the scream. "I think you're really only supposed to stay in hot tubs for like 20 minutes anyway," said Allie. We all wrapped up in towels and hurried inside. The night air was suddenly colder than it had been. Indoors, sealed away from the outside in a well-lit room, the danger we'd all felt rapidly faded away. We were soon embroiled in drinking, card games, and arguments over music until we finally staggered off to bed. Amelia and I were both pleasantly drunk, and we fell asleep wrapped in the blankets and each other's arms, far from any thoughts of the forest and whatever we might have heard in it. It was past 10 o'clock when I woke up the next morning. Amelia was still asleep, but when I wandered out to the main room, I found Allie in the kitchen, clearly also having just woken up. "Mateo's still asleep?" I asked. "No, he was gone when I woke up. I figured I'd find him out here, but I guess he must have gotten up early and gone for a walk." "Maybe he went to go find that chicken of the woods," I said. Wanted to pull off the parts that the pigs had chewed on before the rest of us saw. "Whatever he finds, I'm sure we'll hear all about it when he gets back," Allie said. "First, we wouldn't go walking with him yesterday, and then we all slept in today. Poor guy really wanted to get into the woods. If he finds anything cool, you know he's going to rub it in our faces." We made coffee, poured cereal, and sat around to wait. Eventually, Amelia woke up and joined us, so we kept chatting while she finished her breakfast as well. By the time we'd finished the pot of coffee, it was noon, and there was still no sign of Mateo. "I sent him a text like an hour ago," said Allie. "I tried calling, and he's not picking up." "He's probably just got bad reception," Amelia reassured her. "It is the middle of the woods, after all." "But what if he's hurt and he can't call?" "I'm sure he's fine. Still, what did he mention yesterday? The white loop?" Amelia picked up the trail map from the table and looked at it. "Yeah, so it's like 6 miles. You got up around 10, right? So it makes sense that he'd still be out there." Yeah, said Allie. She turned her coffee cup around in her hands a few times. "Still, I'm going to go look." "We'll come with you," said Amelia. I was already standing up to get my socks and shoes. We followed the path down from the back porch and into the forest. The trees here were huge, towering over us like massive sentinels from a forgotten land. The air smelled earthy and oddly sweet. I studied the dirt path for footprints or other signs of passage, and I realized I had no idea what I was looking for. "Mateo? Mateo!" Allie called. There was no response. "I've still got signal here, at least," said Amelia. She called Mateo's number, but it went to voicemail. After a few minutes, the path forked. A double-ended white arrow was painted on the tree in front of us. "I guess we're done with the spur," Amelia said. "Which way do you want to go?" "We should split up," said Allie. "Absolutely not." "We have to. Think about it. We don't know which way he went. If he lost his phone or something and we go the same way he did, then he'll get back here without us ever seeing him. And if he goes back to the house and stays there, maybe that's fine. But if he comes out looking for us, we could end up going in circles after each other forever. Look, I'll go this way, you two go that way, and we can just stay in contact by phone." "No," I said. "You two go together and I'll go solo." "Is this some macho thing?" demanded Amelia. "It's physics," I said. "I can lift Mateo by myself if I have to. Can either of you do that?" Amelia frowned and narrowed her eyes at me. "Still sounds like a macho thing, but fine, that is a valid point. We'll check in while we walk. Obviously, call if you find him, but otherwise, we'll check in every 15 minutes or so. We should meet up in the middle in about an hour.
We could just stay on the phone.
We've got to keep our eyes and ears open in case he wandered off the path somewhere. It would suck to walk past him because we were distracted talking to each other.
Fine. Check-ins every 5 minutes, though.
Text is fine, but I don't want to have to sweep an entire quarter mile looking for you, too, said Amelia.
Every 5 minutes, then.
We're probably going to find him before the first one, you know. He's probably almost back by now.
Great. Then let's get going so he can laugh at us.
We headed our separate ways. I looked back and caught Amelia looking back at me too, so I gave her a thumbs up. It was bright and sunny in the forest, with dappled shadows and a pleasant breeze, and the path was clearly defined. There was no reason to be worried. Mateo had probably gone a little off trail chasing his chicken of the woods, dropped his phone somewhere, and gotten hung up looking for it. He was fine wherever he was. We just had to find him, and everything would be okay. I wandered along, scanning the surrounding forest and calling Mateo's name every so often. After the first 5 minutes, I texted Amelia.
Nothing yet. You?
Nothing,
she wrote back. I called Mateo's phone, just in case I could hear it ringing somewhere nearby, but it went to voicemail again. I tried to remember if he'd had it on vibrate. I wasn't sure, so it was probably still worth an occasional call. I quickly fell into a pattern. Walk, scan, yell name, repeat. Every 5 minutes, text Amelia, then call Mateo. The walk was nice, and aside from the increasing worry about Mateo, I was enjoying myself. We'd gone far enough, though, that one of our two groups should have found him. When I dialed Mateo after the fifth check-in, I'd gotten so used to the pattern that I almost didn't notice the faint sounds of music from the forest. It wasn't until the message cut into his voicemail and the song stopped that I realized what I'd been hearing. I hung up and called again. There was no question about it. I could hear his ringtone somewhere off to my right. I took a few cautious steps into the woods.
Mateo?
There was no answer, but I was definitely moving toward the song. When it stopped, I hung up and called again. The ringtone played once more, a beacon bringing me in.
Hey man, you okay? I can hear your phone.
Up ahead was a small clearing in the trees, just a mossy patch of ground in the sun. The ringtone sounded like it was coming from there, but the space was totally empty. There was nothing but a large oblong rock at one edge of the clearing, a milky, mottled stone about the size of my torso. I walked closer, confused. The phone cut off, and I redialed Mateo's number once more. The song started again. It was definitely coming from the rock. Had he lost his phone under it? I knelt down and put my hand on the rock to roll it over. It was damp, sticky, and soft to the touch. I pulled my hand back in disgust, and part of what I had thought was a rock ripped away, stuck to my palm. It was a thick, leathery sack of some sort, and Mateo's phone was inside. That wasn't all that was in there, though. There were bones, human bones. Fragments of his skull peered out at me, mixed in among femurs and knuckles and jumbled teeth. I saw pieces of his shoes, his Apple Watch, and other remnants of Mateo. He had been stripped of everything digestible, and what was left had been crammed into this bag and dumped for me to find. I stumbled backward, shaking my hand frantically to free it of the clinging material. I sprinted toward the path, running frantically through vines and trees, ignoring the branches whipping at my face. I hit the trail and began sprinting for home. An instant later, my phone buzzed in my pocket and I screeched to a halt. Amelia and Allie, they were probably halfway through the trail by now and would be heading back this way. I'd love to say that I turned back to save them from whatever they might be walking into, but the honest truth is that I didn't want to be alone. I was willing to run past whatever might have gotten Mateo if it meant having someone to watch my back 20 minutes sooner. I must have looked insane when I came tearing down the trail towards them.
My eyes were wide, my hair was tangled with twigs, and I was bleeding from a small cut on my cheek that I hadn't yet noticed. "You're okay! You're okay!" I was shouting, which is admittedly not the least concerning intro. I slammed into Amelia and gave her a hug.
"What is it? What happened? You didn't answer the last check-in."
"It's Mateo. I found him. I found something. I don't know."
"Is he okay?" Allie asked. "Where is he?"
"The woods. Something got him. Something, I don't know, it's bad."
"Oh my God, Maddie."
Allie started to cry. There were tears running down my cheeks too, mixing with the blood. I wiped them away with the back of my hand, smearing dirt in their place.
"Is he hurt? Is he dead? What happened?"
Amelia demanded.
"We need to get out of here," I insisted. "We need to get back. If he's dead, we need to call the police."
He's in a bag," I said. "He's all bones. He's in a bag."
"You're not making any sense. Something got him. It left the bones, the pieces.
He's gone." Amelia grabbed me by the shoulders.
"You're not making any sense. I'm telling you what I saw."
She looked at Allie, then back at me.
"Show us."
"No, no way."
"What you're saying doesn't make any sense."
"I know what I saw."
"But we don't."
"Show us. Is it far?" I shook my head. "We're almost there."
"Okay. Take us. If you don't, we'll just go without you. It's not that we don't believe you, we just don't understand."
We went back and forth for a while, but the more Amelia spoke in that calm voice, the more I wondered about what I'd actually seen. She was right, after all. It didn't make any sense. What would strip him down to his bones and then bag them up? Nothing worked that way. Even serial killers didn't do that. They'd bury the evidence. Maybe I really had seen something else or misunderstood something. The only way to be sure was to go look. All the while she was convincing me, the forest was pleasant, calm, and normal. It was hard to picture Mateo being dead at all when we were standing in such placid surroundings. But I knew what I'd seen. I just wasn't sure I was right anymore. It took half an hour or more before she convinced me to go back. I led them back down the path cautiously, eyes scanning left and right in case anything was planning to jump out. But nothing did. It took much longer at my careful walk to get back to where I had been, but when I saw the marks in the dirt where I'd burst onto the trail and then skidded to a halt, I knew I was in the right place.
"There. He's over there in the woods," I said. I took out my phone and dialed Mateo's number again.
We all listened as the song started.
"Maddie!"
shouted Allie, immediately pushing her way through the undergrowth.
"Where are you?"
Amelia and I followed close behind.
"Look,"
said Amelia, pointing to a nearby tree branch.
"Is that his watch?"
It was, although I couldn't understand what it was doing on a branch. I'd seen it stuffed into that terrible bag in the clearing up ahead. I knew I had.
"And his wallet," said Allie, scooping something off the ground. "He must have been running from something."
Up ahead, the cell phone song stopped. I redialed the number and it began again, a cheery denial of the growing terror in my gut. Something was wrong. This wasn't how things had been. I could see the clearing now. The bag of bones was gone. Mateo's cell phone glittered in the sunlight, metal and plastic clear against the moss. Amelia started toward the phone.
"It's all in a line. Maybe he tore his pocket open. If we follow..."
She was cut off by an ear-piercing screech from Allie. I could only stare in shock as something swarmed down from the trees, a cluster of things the color of bark that moved in a shifting mass made primarily of stabbing nails and teeth. They swept down from the branches and grabbed her by the hair and head, piercing through her cheeks and dragging her up into the canopy. Amelia lunged to grab Allie's feet, but as she turned her back on the clearing, the ground moved. A great slab of earth whipped open and closed in an instant, and a monstrosity I could barely glimpse seized Amelia in a welter of bristling appendages. I heard her back snap and her skull smash as she was whipped into that underground lair. I knew she was dead before the ground ever settled over her. I stood and stared, my eyes flickering between the empty clearing and the peaceful canopy of leaves overhead. I could hear a muffled rustling from below the ground. There was a soft liquid patter among the trees. It wasn't until a drop of blood landed on my cheek that I finally snapped out of my frozen moment and once again ran. I locked myself in the house when I got back and locked the bedroom door too as an extra barrier. I stayed there, huddled against the wall until I fell asleep late that night. When I woke up the next day, still clothed, dirty, bloody, and alone, I tried to think of what to do, what the right thing would be. I thought about going back. I thought about calling the police. In the end, I showered, changed, and drove home, eyes on the trees around me the whole time. I'll report them as missing. I'll say where we were and that I looked for them and that I didn't find them. That's all true. What good would it be to send more people out there? Even if I told them exactly what I had seen of the thing underground and the swarm in the trees, and even if they believed me completely, it wouldn't be enough. Whatever those monsters were, the huge lurker and the swarm of tiny things, they were not the same. They were working together, each using the other to draw, distract, and devour prey. And if there are two of these horrific things, how many more might there be?
Moro Casino, American Social Casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, American Social Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
You've been listening to Ecosystem by Micah Edwards. Micah Edwards graduated from William & Mary with a degree in English and no particular plans to use it. He now finds himself occupying various roles as an author, a comedian, and a database administrator, depending on the day of the week. He resides in Richmond, Virginia, the world's premier home of authors named Micah Edwards. To close out our episode, here's The Derelict by Christian Wallace.
"Right," I said, raising my voice on deck to make sure I could be heard. There were four of us, me up front, and three others lounging around on deck chairs. "What have we got so far?"
"And the anchor's bad," Cole answered, sitting upright to rub a hand over his shaved head. "I'm not sure I'll be able to get it up. It's held out for 30 years and isn't coming easy."
"Well, we kind of need to get it up," I replied, "especially if we're going to get this baby to a dock."
"If we need to," he said, "we can cut it, but I'm not sure we've got anything that can do the job."
"I'll speak to Haseem's men," I replied. "How's the rudder?"
"Looking good," Gareth answered. "The rudder's looking good."
"Anything else?"
"We found a leak," Charlie said, crossing her boots with a sigh. "Bottom deck's flooded, but we can't be sure why the water level hasn't risen further."
"Leak's bad news," Gareth groaned. "It is," I said. "Let's get down there. Charlie, Cole, you ready for a dive?"
"Aye, aye,"
they cried.
"Already brought the suits up," Charlie added.
"Sounds good," I said. "Let's get going." With that, Charlie and Cole left. Out of all of us, they had the hardest job, and from the keen looks in their eye as they made their way below deck, they took it seriously. I nodded approvingly at Gareth as he walked over. He handed me a coffee
and we began to carefully pick our way across the open deck where we stood. It looked like it had been a sunbathing area with a nearby bar. Now, all that furniture was just broken wreckage left strewn across the floor.
"They're good guys," I said. "They're taking all this well."
"It does seem pretty good on paper, doesn't it?" Gareth said. We had been hired ahead of any other crew and sent to board the ship on our own. Our job was to have some kind of inventory ready to go the second the buyer's crew arrived. After that, we would organize and manage the repair effort based on our initial reports.
"It does," I said. "I would say that, except..."
"Nothing feels good about this place?" Gareth asked.
"You have to wonder, don't you, looking at all this shit?" I picked up an old handbag that had been lying on the floor. "I know it was a sudden evacuation, but I'm not sure the captain went crazy like they say."
"You think it was something else?" Gareth asked, arching one eyebrow towards me. "This place is creepy, but I've just been putting it down to nerves."
"I don't know." I shrugged and tossed the handbag to the floor. "It'd help if it was a big story, you know. If there were articles and interviews with pissed-off passengers standing on some dock with dripping wet hair, moaning about how the captain had abandoned ship for no damn reason." I showed him the purse I'd taken from the handbag, opening it up to reveal a faded driver's license. "I just get a funny feeling when I look at stuff like this. I know it was 30 years ago, but you'd think there'd be something online, wouldn't you? The rescue effort must have been huge."
"You think conspiracy?"
"I don't know," I said. "This place just feels weird."
"It's just the heebie-jeebies," he replied, doing his best to make us both feel a little better. "Besides, I mean, well, we're here now."
"True," I nodded. "You're probably right. Just the heebie-jeebies." Gareth chuckled at my use of probably.
"I gotta go," he said. "This conversation isn't doing me any favors."
I waited for him to leave, shouting a final thanks for the coffee. He waved goodbye, and I watched him turn a corner. Once he was gone, I opened the purse again and ruffled through the papers. Most of them were old receipts, but something caught my eye. A folded square of old paper towel, something taken from a dinner table, perhaps. It was wrapped around an old dinner knife. The tip was snapped off and nowhere to be seen. I unrolled it and found a message written in old lipstick. The writing is desperate, the letters jagged and harsh. "They hurt me," it read. "What the hell is that supposed to mean?" I whispered.
"Get up here!"
Gareth's voice sounded tinny and distant. I was alone, hearing it filtered through the radio at my waist.
"What is it?" I asked.
"You've become fucking nuts. You won't..."
"Fuck's sake," I grumbled.
"All right, where are you?"
"Top deck. It's zing."
"Gareth, you still there?"
I cried before resigning myself to a short walk.
"This better be fucking good."
Only when I climbed all the way to the top deck, I found it empty. Deck chairs were stacked toward the aft, and parasols, bleached white in the sun, lay torn and lifeless along the floor. Occasionally, a gust of wind would catch one of the shredded flaps, and it would struggle like a bird with a broken wing, the sudden sound touching a nerve deep inside me. Most of this deck was taken up by a large swimming pool, the scum-covered surface disturbed only by old foam toys and deflated beach balls that floated eerily in the wind. Each one was a furry shape engulfed in algae, pacing those choked waters like patient predators. Directly ahead was a water slide, a twisting, multicolored tunnel of plastic that rose upwards for 30 feet. It looked faded and pale and was grown over with speckles of green algae. Halfway up, one of the sections turned transparent, offering a once tantalizing view of the sea. Something caught my eye up there, and to get a better view, I walked around the edge of the pool until the acrylic caught the sun and I could see right through it. There was a fuzzy, dark shape. Something that, if I squinted just right, looked like it could be big enough to be a person. Suddenly, my radio flared up, and I caught the tail end of Gareth's voice.
"Gonna help! Stop! Fuck!"
The shape moved silently against the hard plastic.
It looked like there could be someone stuck up there. Is that him? I wondered.
Gareth, where are you?
Up here. It must be him, I decided, and I couldn't quite work out what to feel about that. I sure as hell wanted to be angry. I had to assume it was him, didn't I? There was no one else, so it had to be. And that meant I'd have to crawl up there and help him out. And that, I guess that was where my thoughts started to dribble away like candle wax. Because going up there was just about the scariest fucking thing I could imagine doing. It wasn't just the thought of the danger. It was that place. Even just walking around the pool, stepping quietly over old swimsuits and dropped champagne flutes, I felt as if any second something was going to lunge out and pull me down, and I would disappear into that opaque, slimy water. The pool would be deathly still within seconds, and if anyone came looking, they'd never know I'd even been up there. They'd never even know what happened.
"Gareth," I cried as I reached the foot of the ladder. This is a seriously fucking stupid thing you've done.
I must be alone up here, I told myself, barring Gareth. I know I am because nothing else makes sense. No one's aboard this thing except us. And if I am alone, then I have to help. There's no two ways about it. He could get seriously hurt in the time it takes me to find the others. Any feelings I have about those murky waters are irrational. Just like that old church I had to walk past as a kid. It looked scary, that was all. This place looks scary. But it's dead. Lifeless. Nothing to be afraid of. So, I took my first step, and immediately noticed the awful noise that rickety frame made. Every footfall on the ladder rattled all that metal and the plastic sides like an earthquake, and it took every ounce of courage to get up there. I'm not often afraid of heights, but up there you felt like you were standing on a collapsing tower. Every gentle turn of the ship was magnified 1,000-fold, so that even I started to feel a pang of seasickness. Not thinking, I crawled towards the tunnel entrance and went in head first, hoping to get this all over and done with. The plastic was dry as a bone, and my hands gripped it easily, so that was something. I pulled myself along at a good pace, uncomfortably aware of how the claustrophobic tube was made for bodies much smaller than mine. How Gareth had thought it was a good idea to go down was beyond me, and I spent most of the way swearing quietly under my breath. The furious muttering was a nice release, enough to keep me going until I reached the acrylic see-through tube. Somehow, the space before me was empty. I'd arrived at the midsection only to find a scratched view of the cloudy sky. For a moment, I replayed events in my head. Had I seen what I thought I had? Or had he somehow gotten free? But there was no way he could have gone down. With the way the slide was rocking, I would have noticed, and he definitely didn't come my way. But the proof was before my eyes. He wasn't there. I was alone. Or so I hoped.
"Gareth," I cried, "the fuck are you playing at?"
I don't know why I shouted anything. I hadn't wanted to hear a reply, not even from Gareth. What I wanted, what was slowly expanding in my mind like a blooming star, eclipsing every other thought, was to get the hell out. But something did reply. A thud. A loud and angry sound coming from the very bottom of the tunnel, out of sight. And I didn't just hear it. I felt it. The tunnel shook. The vibrations passed up my hands. Another thud, and my whole body locked down with terror. "Something's coming," I thought. My skin grew cold, my scalp tightened, and my heart started skipping every other beat. There were a few more explorative thumps before they exploded into a galloping spring, the owner barreling up that slide with unseen fury. Something inside me finally broke. I began to backpedal in a crab walk, not even bothering to turn. Only now, my hands gripped nothing. The once firm plastic was smooth and slick, and I couldn't get enough traction to pull myself upwards. I lost all coordination and had to fight with everything I had just to keep myself in one place, my feet kicking black marks into the vinyl and my hands squeaking against the plastic.
I wanted to turn, but I couldn't take my eyes off that bend in the tunnel. What will come around there? I thought. What stinking wet thing is speeding towards me? I don't know if it was sweat or just clumsiness, but eventually what little grip I had gave way. The tunnel seemed steeper than it ever had before, and gravity finally started to bear my weight downwards. For long, agonizing seconds, the plastic was as slippery as ice, and I was helpless to stop myself moving. My mind turned white hot with terror, and all my thoughts were burned away and replaced with a near hallucinatory state of despair. I screamed the whole way down, only to land in that wretched green water with a bassy plunk, the soup-like liquid too thick to give off any splash. I broke the water in a state of total hysteria, gagging as I sucked in lungfuls of rotten miasma. That organic soup had been stewing for 3 decades, and if I had to guess, I was the first thing to break the surface for a long, long time. The result was near intoxicating, enough to leave me on the cusp of unconsciousness. But I fought to stay lucid and pushed through that stringy muck, its hairy tendrils clinging to my wrists and ankles with an almost lifelike animation, and heaved myself over the pool's edge to collapse on the floor. There, I lay panting, confused and desperate, only to hear something else come from the pool beside me. Kaplunk. The water looked undisturbed, but then again it would, wouldn't it? It was hardly even water, more like a tangle of weeds and slimy algae suspended in ooze. Something was in there. I knew it. It was an irrational thought, one of many I'd had in the last few minutes. But God, I was certain that there was something in that damned water. Another sound. A loud screech. The sound of a child riding a slide. I looked up and saw the water slide's mouth rimmed by a dozen pale hands. Children's hands. Their owners crouched out of sight in darkness. I ran screaming from that deck, unable to wait any longer, unwilling to take the risk of seeing who or what would emerge from that water. Gareth found me lowering bags onto the deck of our yacht below, my clothes rancid and dripping wet. I jumped when he called my name, and he jogged over with concern on his face. "We're leaving," I said as soon as he was within hearing range. "We're getting the fuck out of Dodge. Get Cole, get Charlie. Let's go." I could see that Gareth was about to tell me something urgent, but then the state of my clothes caught his eye and he stopped himself. "What happened?" he asked. I don't know," I said. "Did you radio me to get up on top deck?" "No," he shook his head. "Have you spoken to me at all this morning, after our meeting?" "No." "So you didn't stay in contact with..." "What are you on about? I haven't radioed you once. What the hell happened to you? Did you go for a swim?" he asked incredulously. "Not voluntarily," I answered, "and I didn't go alone." "What's that supposed to mean?" "This place is fucked," I said. "Something is aboard this ship, and it took a shot at me, and I'm not about to give it a second chance. Get Charlie and Cole before they dive. Tell them we're leaving in the next 20 minutes. Gareth's face darkened. "Cole hasn't surfaced," he said. "They went down, but he never came back up, and Charlie's down there, passed out. I didn't want to move her, but I don't know what's wrong. Did someone attack you up here? Do you think they hurt Cole?" I didn't have time to explain everything to Gareth, so I grabbed him and tried to give him the Cliff's Notes as we hurried to where he'd left Charlie down below. He kept poking holes in my story along the way, and oh boy, did that piss me off. I had to guess he was just trying to rationalize it, but I felt like he was maybe missing the point. We weren't alone, and that was all I needed to set my ass sailing towards the horizon. By the time we reached Charlie, I think I'd certainly spooked the guy a little bit. He looked shaken up, but I'm not sure he believed my story word for word, like he thought I'd maybe taken a tumble and knocked my head on the way down that slide. Not that it mattered, something I was reminded of when we found Charlie changing out of her suit. She was in a mad rush. "We need to fucking go," she cried, scrambling towards us with her things in hand. "We can't leave," Gareth said. "We have to get Cole." "Nuh-uh," Charlie shook her head.
He's gone. Whatever the fuck was down there, it got him. We gotta go.
You sure? I asked.
Yes, she answered. I tried. Believe me, I tried, but... But he's gone.
Let's go, I said. For the love of God, let's just fucking go. To our soul-crushing horror, when we reached the railing, we found nothing but gray water staring up at us. Perplexed, I reached out and gave the rope a tug, almost as if to check the very truth of my senses. Just a short while ago, I'd been climbing that rope and loading the yacht below. By definition, the yacht had to be wherever the rope was. They simply had to be together. So how could there be one without the other? We stood there in a traumatized silence, until at last Gareth spoke up.
What happened down there, Charlie? He asked. What the fuck is going on?
Give it up, I said, as Gareth tried the backup radio for what must have been the 100th time that hour. We know Hasim's men will be here sooner or later.
It's just fucking stupid, he cried. It was working this morning, all of them were. How the hell can it be down now? We have a radio, a backup for the backup, four different satellite.
It's this place, Charlie said. Her legs pulled up to her chest as she took a long drag from a cigarette. It's got us where it wants us.
What the fuck does that even mean? Gareth cried. You know exactly what I mean, she said. I told you plain as day, something took Cole. One second he was there, the next he wasn't.
You can't even say what it was, he replied.
For all you know, he got stuck on something and we could... He was fucking dead, Gareth. I found his damn mask.
There could be an air pocket.
He's dead, Charlie said, slowly withdrawing back into herself, her eyes glazing over. That leak we found was repaired. We weren't the first to come here and try patching her up. And whatever got the last fuckers before they could pump the water is going to get us next.
Charlie, I said, sitting beside her with deep concern. It would help me a lot if we knew what we were dealing with. What else did you see? She shuddered and took a long, slow breath.
People, she said. Or bodies. Lots and lots and lots of them. I'd say 2, maybe 3 dozen. All of them were crew. Those little white uniforms gone gray and rotten in the water. I saw a few officers down there, I think. They were just bones, so it looked almost like coral at first, until I got closer. That was where I found Cole's mask, sticking out from old ribs and femurs like it had always been there. But it was his, all right. All those bones were piled up against one wall like those people had been crawling towards it. Something had been drawn on it, maybe. I don't know, it looked charred, like fire had been taken to it. I couldn't look at it long, though. Seeing that mask, those bones, just... We're not alone. I know you don't believe me, but I'm telling you, we're not alone. I wasn't in that water alone. Things moved. The currents, you could feel them crawling across your skin, and the shadows never stayed still. There was something down there, just out of sight, always just out of my fucking sight. It had me going in circles until my air damn nearly ran out. If I'd kept going, kept trying to find it, and really lay my hands on it, I would have drowned down there too. You know the last thing Cole said before he went missing? Before something snatched him right out from under my nose? He said, "Who's that?"
Something about Charlie's story wormed its way right into my head. I could practically see that place with all those dead skeletons trying to claw their way towards God knows what. Could sense and feel the deathly silence hanging in the water. Fuck. Was just about all I could manage to say, muttering it under my breath.
Well, what do we do now? Gareth asked.
And that was when someone knocked on the door.
Room service.
The voice was Cole's.
Sir, I've been asked to bring you some room service on the house.
I couldn't quite believe my eyes. Cole was standing just outside the door, back straight and arms to his side. A trolley full of hidden silver dishes was beside him. He looked paler than he ever had in life,
like a powdered corpse. He was shaking, and a thin trickle of sweat rolled across his brow, his eyes fixated on some distant spot behind me. "Cole?" Charlie heard me say his name, and she immediately rushed over and pushed me aside. She saw it was him, really, truly him. But before she could get close, something stopped her. It was the same thing that had kept me frozen at the doorway. Cole didn't really look like Cole. It was him, sure, but he looked like he'd gone through the ringer, like he was watching his child's coffin get lowered into the ground. He kept licking his lips like he was going to say something, only he didn't quite seem sure what. "Cole, what happened to you?"
"Quite the spread, sir," he said, putting his hand on the trolley's handle. It's on the house."
His words were wooden, like a recited script. For some reason, I imagined a hostage speaking into a phone with a gun against their head. That was exactly what he looked like. He was expecting something of us, I'm sure, but I couldn't say what. By now, Gareth was behind me, every bit as confused as the rest of us. Cole smiled like he was about to burst into tears, and then he turned stiffly and walked away. We exchanged brief looks of confusion and immediately followed, calling and shouting for him to stop, but he only sped up. He moved quickly as well. Whenever we got close, he'd turn a corner, and by the time we made it around, he'd be way down the corridor. Only he never ran. He was always impossibly far ahead after every twist and turn. It was as if he was sprinting when out of sight and slowing to a leisurely walk whenever we got close. But why? I thought. What the hell is he playing at? The chase didn't last long. He soon disappeared from sight, and we were left alone in just another one of those endless velvet corridors. I tried to see where he might have gone, but it was useless to look for him. He could have been anywhere. In despondent silence, we returned to our room, only to suddenly remember the trolley he'd left behind. We lifted each lid and found plates covered in rancid mulch, the food so rotten you couldn't even tell what it had once been. "Why did he want us to eat this?" Gareth asked. "Was that even him?" "I'd like to take a look at the kitchen," I said. "I'd like to know where this came from." The food had been scooped out of some rotten sacks around the back. Ancient, vacuum-sealed packs of beef torn open and plopped onto cracked ceramic in a hysterical rush. You could see where he dropped plates and old meat and had to start again. You could also see half a dozen hypodermic needles littering the ground, and on one countertop was a plain old toolbox filled with every type of sedative you could imagine. It was an old thing, the hinges rusted, but a grimy outline in one of the cupboards close to the back let me know it had always been a fixture of that kitchen. I couldn't help but think of that note I'd found in the old handbag. "They hurt us."
"The fucker tried to drug us. Do you think he's gone nuts?" Gareth asked.
"I think we have a job ahead of us," I answered. "I think we need to go back to our rooms and figure out our supply situation. I also think we need to work out shifts for keeping a watch during the night."
"So you think he wants to hurt us?" Gareth nodded towards the toolbox.
"I don't understand what happened to him. We've known him for years."
"I don't think it's him we need to worry about," Charlie answered. "It's whatever got to him."
Something was hissing. I was sure of it. I was up late watching over the others, and something in the room was letting out a quiet whisper of white static. Gareth and Charlie were both asleep, and I was halfway through the midnight watch. At 4 a.m., Gareth would wake up and take over, and I'd finally get some rest. But until then, it was just me and my thoughts, and the deeply worrying sound of Cole occasionally shuffling around somewhere in the distance. And that hiss. If I could only figure out where it was coming from. But I was reticent to start walking around in case I woke the others. God, we were tense enough as it was without me worrying over some little thing. I tried to focus on the front door, hoping that whoever else was on this ship would leave us alone. At least we had a fair amount of supplies. We'd brought enough to last the whole stay, something we owed to Gareth's particularly anxious mind. He was always doing things like that, stashing away enough food for twice the journey and always bringing backups for backups. I quietly thanked him while I drank from a bottle of Coke. I paused with the bottle to my lips, hearing the carbonated bubbles hiss. I brought the bottle back down and screwed the cap on. The hiss diminished, but it didn't disappear, and when I shook the bottle, it rose to a shrill whistle. Carefully examining the lid, I noticed a tiny hole in the plastic. It was so small that when I tipped the bottle, nothing flowed out, but once upright, the pressure was high enough to force a tiny trickle of air back out. "What the fuck?" I muttered, speaking aloud for the first time in a few hours. Only my words had sounded a little slurred, and my lips felt a little weak. I thought of the needles in that kitchen, of the sheer quantity of sedatives tucked away. I rushed over to the stack of bottles we had and began to pull them out, cursing as my arms and legs grew weak and sluggish. Every bottle had a tiny pinprick in the top. "Guys," I whispered, my limbs so numb I had to crawl my way over to the two sleeping forms. "Charlie?" I reached out and shook her, but she didn't wake. She was sleeping so heavily she barely looked alive. We'd all been eating and drinking from that stock. It was our own, so we'd assumed we were safe. But of course, Cole would have known about it. "Shit," I cried, falling backwards and feeling the world start to swim around me. The last thing I heard was the sound of our door opening and Cole muttering quietly under his breath. "He's hungry."
Moro Casino, American Social Casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, American Social Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
"Dave, wake up." I had to fight to pull myself up. I'd been left on the floor where I'd fallen, my neck and shoulders badly hurt. Slowly, I realized I hadn't left the room, and I wondered if I dreamed the whole damn thing. Then Charlie spoke again, and the nightmare was renewed.
"He's gone, Dave," Charlie cried. "He's fucking gone. Gareth is gone."
I looked down and saw that his sleeping bag was empty.
"He drugged us,"
I grunted, grabbing the nearby bottle and handing it to Charlie. "Injected something into the lid. Look."
"Fuck,"
she screamed, hurling the bottle against the wall where it bounced harmlessly onto the floor.
"He must have come here when we went looking in the kitchen."
"We need to search for him," I said. The medical facility aboard the ship was small, but densely packed with chairs, tables, and dozens of old cabinets. When the ship was still sailing, there would have been maybe a few medics or a single doctor aboard to treat mild injuries or illnesses. But should anything severe happen, most cruise ships simply turned around and dumped the injured passenger at port to seek medical help on land. So why did this one have an operating theater, I wondered. When I first saw that gurney with leather straps and an overhead light, I thought I simply had to be mistaken. But there was no denying it. The tanks full of nitrous and other gases, the trolley full of rusted scalpels. Jesus, the drain in the floor to collect any blood. This wasn't your average professional operating theater. The straps to restrain the table's occupant made that pretty clear. It was a small DIY space with no real room to move or do anything except get someone horizontal and begin cutting away with no thought to what came after. The doorway had been hidden behind old filing cabinets that had since toppled over, and you got a powerful sense that you were standing in a place that was meant to be kept a secret. It had been Gareth's screams that led us to this place. We never found him, at least not there and then. But we chased those shrill cries for help from one end of the ship to the other until, at last, we tracked it to this tiny little space. Charlie said we must have been late, and I didn't quite have the guts to say anything else afterwards. That overhead light had been on when we first entered. The padlock to the door was opened and lying on the floor, and all along that table were little channels filled with blood
that dripped slowly onto the floor, ready to circle the drain. Yes, I thought, we were too late. We didn't find much else to clue us in as to what happened to Gareth, but we did find an old doctor's bag with paperwork stuffed inside. It didn't make much sense, but reading it... God, you got a horrible feeling you were reading the product of a twisted or broken mind.
Passenger salts will be ready for collection between 0:00 and 200 hours. Do not return later than 400 hours. Passenger sleeps with company. Observations show they're both early risers. Passenger Lauren will be ready for collection between 0:00 and 0:200 hours. Passenger Lauren is in a single occupancy cabin. Observations show she sleeps late due to nightly alcohol consumption. Effects of alcohol withdrawal may be used to mask the effect of sedatives. Prepare her cabin appropriately upon her return. Passenger Jacobson will be ready for collection between 1200 and 1400 hours. Passenger Jacobson will be staying with the childcare facility on Deck 3. Crew member Fillon will prepare Passenger Jacobson for collection. Use of sedatives unnecessary given passenger's age. Reports of behavioral problems to be prepared for parents' return at 1800 hours. If parents seek to escalate, the matter may be brought to the medical department where appropriate documents and diagnoses will be devised to diminish the impact of Passenger Jacobson's narrative. Passengers Morris, Athley, and Supton have been selected for further observation. In the event they are inappropriate for collection, passengers Wettle, Dibson, and Gillette remain potential alternatives. Further notes, crew member Eileen Tucson has filed a report with the captain. She has expressed concern regarding safety of children aboard the ship, citing several mentions of the Hungry Man. This is the third report since she joined the crew 4 months ago, following complaints regarding kitchen and medical staff. Report was intercepted. Crew member Tucson was reprimanded for inappropriate conduct with passengers. Those were only some of dozens and dozens. And if I had to guess, there was probably a place somewhere on this ship where we'd find hundreds more. They weren't dated, but you got a twisted sense of chronology anyway. Passenger Donahue will be ready for collection between 0:00 and 0:200 hours. Passenger Donahue will be undergoing his third collection since starting his journey, and has consequently stopped eating meals prepared by crew. Sedation is impossible. Prepare appropriately for resistance. Passenger Nguyen will be ready for collection between 1430 and 1500 hours. Observations show that Passenger Nguyen is rarely separated from their spouse. Complaints or official inquiries regarding Passenger Nguyen's location are to be directed towards complicit members of the medical and officer staff only. Room service personnel are on hand to provide a third as-yet-unidentified candidate for collection between the hours of 0:00 and 0:600. Further notes... The captain has escalated the situation. His capacity for disruption is significant. We are unable to direct the ship to return to port and collect new passengers. He has reported damage to the hull that is not present and has drawn significant attention from the Coast Guard. Corporate are working towards correcting the situation. Passenger population will return to normal in the coming weeks. I handed the last one to Charlie and waited for her to read it. I don't like that corporate reference, I said. I don't like that Hungry Man thing, she replied. What was this place? I shook my head in confusion and picked up another. This one was considerably shorter. Crew member Fillon will be ready for collection at 0:600 hours. Crew should remain vigilant for collection opportunities among remaining passengers. Some activity has been reported in the nursery on Deck 3. Surviving passengers have proven difficult to collect, children included. He gives as well as takes. They are changed. Further notes, given the meager offerings, decks 1, 2, and 3 are off limits. It is unlikely he will be satisfied with current supplies. All remaining crew should be prepared for spontaneous collection. Do not resist him. Corporate reports that efforts to return the ship to full functioning are underway, but significant resources are being directed towards containing any information leaks after the recent evacuation. We must bear this period of scarcity with stoicism. Looks like not everyone got off, I said, handing it to Charlie without looking.
Some of the crew stayed behind, some of the passengers too. I think this place had something of a cult going on. Only Charlie wasn't listening. She had wandered over to a nearby counter and, opening drawers at random, had found another sheet of paper. It was shaking so badly in her hand that I had to reach out and take it just to read the words. She didn't even resist. She just kept looking at her empty hand, her eyes wide and glistening. Passenger Gareth Jones will be ready for collection between 0200 and 0400 hours. Observations show passengers will not sleep alone. Sedatives have been prepared for entire group. Crew member Cole must wait for sedatives to take effect. Further notes. Passenger Cole Webb has joined the crew. This represents a significant increase to current staff levels. Expect passengers Jones, Wallace, and Mitchell to join the crew within the week. It has been lonely. We've given so much. And so has he. His gifts hurt. We had barricaded our room as best we could. Only it didn't amount to much. This time, it wasn't Cole, or even Gareth, as I'd suspected he might, that came for us. It was something else that didn't pretend to be anything except a monster. A clicking, drooling, shuffling thing, with broken bones and sagging skin that glistened in the moonlight like rancid meat. It silently pulled our door apart with heavy breaths that gurgled wetly in the dark. You could smell its hunger, its desperation. It didn't groan or cry or roar. It only worked towards its prey like a determined predator driven by nothing but a mindless animal instinct. It was in the room within minutes. We could hear it tearing the supplies we'd brought apart. Suitcases were hurled against the wall and tool bags tipped upside down. Its breathing grew rapid and more strained as the thing continued to search for us. Meanwhile, we hid in the room two doors down, clutching ourselves in the pitch-black bathroom with our breath held tight. Only once had I ventured out to the door to look at what was tearing our room apart, and the single glimpse had been enough to nearly turn my mind to jelly. Whatever was out there looked human in its general outline, but that was where the resemblance ended. I couldn't help but think of what we'd read. Is this what happens after so many collections? I wondered. Is this what will happen to Cole and Gareth if we leave them? Is this what will happen to me? I didn't want those kinds of gifts. Charlie eventually fell asleep, but I never could. I'd heard the thing wander off into the darkness, crying in rage and terror. It had wanted so badly to find us, and I knew, on some level, it would never stop.
Do you think it'll float? She asked.
I'll fucking swim the rest of the way if I have to, I said, giving the tiny lifeboat a kick. We'd thrown it together out of some old double doors and a few empty drums. It was desperate, but so were we. Besides, we're betting on the radios and EPIRBs suddenly working out in water, which I'm pretty sure they will.
You think they can do that? She asked. Block our calls for help?
I thought of what I'd seen in the slide, of those little hands and the quiet plunk of something falling into the water. Yes. We hauled the raft overboard and waited for it to settle. Charlie was clutching the orange duffel bag full of provisions as if it was a child, and I couldn't blame her. Things had taken a desperate turn, and all our hopes were pinned on it. We were getting ready to climb down to it when a loud echoing bang shattered the silence. It sounded like a circuit breaker, like some great machine coming to life. Before we'd even turned, we found ourselves bathed in an amber light, and the whole ship was lit up in a mockery of life.
Go!
Charlie cried, and we hurried to the rope ladder. She threw me the bag, and I climbed over first. And for a brief moment, Charlie and I were face to face. We'd spent the whole night cooped up in that little room, unable to sleep or relax. And we'd spent all day working on this last-ditch effort at escape. You could see the stress and horror written across her face. She looked like a terrified child, lost and alone in the dark. And she couldn't even see what was behind her. I tried calling out, tried to warn her,
but before I could get a word out, she was snatched from before me. Whatever it was had come out of the nearby window, shattering glass and steel like it was clay. It moved so quickly I barely registered its existence on my retina, but the slightest smear was still enough to leave me paralyzed on the ladder, my muscles seized with unspeakable terror. The Hungry Man. She was gone in an instant, and I was left with a choice. I looked down at the raft. It was still there, bobbing away. It promised a chance to leave, a chance to get off that damned ship like I'd wanted to that very first day. Meanwhile, the ship continued to whir into monstrous life, and looking up towards its moonlit silhouette, I glimpsed an ancient, creaking body crouched on the nearest roof, its spider-like limbs contracted and ready to spring, waiting for me to return. It was like some shadow come to life. I took a deep breath and climbed down. They went back. The Coast Guard went back and looked for them. I told them not to bother, but they went anyway, unwilling or unable to believe my story. I hoped that, with over a dozen of them crawling from room to room, they had a chance of being safe, although I suspected the ship would not easily let go of fresh meat. Hearing myself say this to them, it was like hearing someone else talk. I spoke of curses and hauntings like a stark raving lunatic driven mad by exposure. I was surprised they even listened to me and tried to look for the others, but not as surprised as when they found Gareth. They took me a little more seriously after that. He'd been found in a random passenger cabin sleeping under the covers. I dread the poor soul who'd first pulled back the duvet only to find themselves face to face with the much changed Gareth. In another time, the ship would have taken its pound of meat slowly and carefully, distributing the load across several passengers a day, with a constant rotation of new ones getting on at each port. If I had to guess, what happened to Gareth was a pride of hungry lions tearing apart a zebra. Something violent and insane. He died before they got 100 yards from the ship. I'm thankful for that little mercy, although it breaks my heart to know that Cole and Charlie will never know that peace. I've thought about going back, about burning it to the ground or blowing a hole below the waterline and letting it sink. Only, I can't go near the water, not anymore. And the thought of seeing that ship rising on the horizon, I could no more return than I could fly to the moon. I simply cannot go back. Nassim acted like I'd done him a favor. He firmly believed me when I told him it was haunted, and he offloaded it as quickly as he could to some poor dupe from Bangladesh. Only, a little digging showed me it was just another shell corporation for a company he owned. I'm not sure he was as ignorant as he claimed, but then again, I'm not sure it even matters. In the end, I ended up finding an old passenger, a middle-aged woman who'd been there as a child. She'd seemed normal, or at least pretty normal. But when I made mention of the Hungry Man, she lost all semblance of calm and fell into a total state of hysteria. Her husband threatened me and forced me out of their house. But I guess it wasn't that which bothered me too much. It was the fact her kids had started crying as well. And for the briefest of moments, I'd felt a shadow pass over me. And the room had grown a little darker. And I saw something, something in the corner of my eye, the kind of thing a mad person might even want to worship as a god. His gifts hurt. I remember those words clearly. Whatever had happened to those passengers, I think they took a little piece of it back with them, carrying it inside like a smuggled package back out into the world. That was The Derelict by Christian Wallace. Christian Wallace is a PhD student and writer hailing from rain-soaked Wales, where he grew up comforted by ancient castles, crumbling coastlines, and the old things that live in the woods.
You can find more of his stories at chwallace.co.uk and at Velux Books. I don't know about you, friends, but I'm already sunburnt, covered in bug bites, and feeling strangely alive. Not really my preferred state of being, so I'll be returning to my dungeon now, where things are dank and familiar. Besides, up there, outside, there are all sorts of people. Ugh. Well, two people that I actually enjoy are Micah Edwards and Christian Wallace, and I'd like to thank them for tonight's stories. And, since I seem to have some residual positivity after my brush with daylight earlier, I suppose I should thank you all as well. Be sure to come back next week for more Horror Hill, and until then, stay spooky. You've been listening to the Horror Hill Podcast, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. Tonight's episode was hosted, narrated, scored, and finalized by yours truly, Eric Peabody. Additional music by Nikki McSorley. Got a terrifying tale of your own that you'd like performed? Email it to us at submissions@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your work considered for future production. If you enjoyed tonight's episode, why not help us spread our dark presence online? You can follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights on social media, and upvote, subscribe, and hit the bell notification icon if you're listening to this on YouTube. It helps us out a lot, and also keeps you up to date on new episodes. If you'd like access to uninterrupted horror, free of ads and these annoying bookend segments, might I recommend signing up to be a patron? You'll get access to hundreds of episodes of this show, as well as everything from the other programs in the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights cabal. That means all of Scary Stories Told in the Dark, Drew Blood's Dark Tales, and more. It's a veritable smorgasbord of horrific delights. Head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com to get started. If you're looking for someone to narrate or handle audio production for your own personal project, I just so happen to know a guy. Email me at ericpeabodyvoice@gmail.com and we can talk details. That's ericpeabodyvoice@gmail.com. If darkness is what you're after, listener, your search is over. Yet, let it be known, you haven't found the darkness. The darkness has found you.
Uncle Laser here. America's built on fast cars, fast food, and even faster women. Photo Casino's built in America. You know what they're fast at? Fast cash prize redemption. You see, only Moto is U.S. owned and operated. Moto, it's American made. That's who we are, and that's who we care about. Play for free at Moto.us.
Moto Casino's the social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
¿Quieres mejor internet? Cox Internet de 300 megas tiene las velocidades rápidas y confiables que buscas. Perfecto para streaming y gaming y trabajar desde casa. Todo por solo $45 al mes cuando agregas Cox Mobile. Incluye equipo de Wi-Fi y garantía de precio de 2 años en tu plan. No esperes. Cámbiate hoy a Cox. Requiere Cox Mobile Gig Unlimited. Garantía de precio no incluye impuestos y cargos. Velocidad de datos móviles se reduce después de 20 gigas al mes.